This is Tax at the Speed of Tech, a podcast from BDO's Tax Practice. Each episode, we'll connect with inspiring thought leaders to get their take on pressing issues in tax and technology innovation, impactful trends, as well as their predictions for the future.
Today, we are going to talk about the brain. Sure, we are all professionals and we use our brains daily, well beyond compelling our bodies consciously and unconsciously to eat, breathe, move, etc. Also, as tax technologists, we are thriving in a technical subject matter, so you might assume that the audience is generally good at using their brains, smarter than the average bear, so to speak. But why spend time talking about the brain, more specifically about neuroscience? Humor me for a moment. While the brain is technically not a muscle, it can certainly languish due to neglect and conversely improve with exercise. If we are willing to spend 5, 6, or even 7 figures of precious budget to improve the function of the tax department through technology, surely we could spend 30 minutes talking about improving the function of our brains, especially if we all agree that improving brain function can have a tangible impact on the quality of life, work product, and on innovation and creative thinking. In this sense, considering implications of neuroscience on our teams parallels the implications of employing tax technology in strengthening our propensity to achieve great things. Lastly, we'll also delve into the potential implications on the brain of an automation-rich environment versus a more manual, risk-prone process. Now, I was fortunate enough recently to complete a course with the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Executive Education School entitled Understanding the Brain, Using Neuroscience to Deliver Better Business Results, taught by our guest today, Dr. Michael Platt. Dr. Platt is the director of Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, a James S. Reapy University professor, professor of marketing at the Wharton School, professor of psychology, and professor of neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania. I am pleased to have him with us today. Welcome, Dr. Platt.
Well, thank you so much, Christopher. It's really great to be here. And yeah, thanks for taking my course too.
I loved it. Absolutely. This is truly an honor. Before I ask you about the course and some of the things I alluded to earlier, if you wouldn't mind, please introduce yourself for everyone.
Yeah, well, you gave a pretty good introduction there. So my name is Michael Platt. And I have this really amazing gig at Penn where, I'm kind of like a bench neuroscientist by day, marketing professor by night, if you will. So I do, I'm a neuroscientist for the last, more than 25 years. Actually, my background is in anthropology. So I started out, my undergraduate and PhD were both in anthropology, which was to me the kind of broadest lens through which I could try to understand human nature. So what makes us tick, what makes some people tick similarly to others, and why do some people tick well together and others certainly do not. By the time I had kind of finished my PhD, I realized if I really wanted to understand that question and go deeper, I had to go beneath the hood, right? I had to be able to look underneath the hood and see what's going on inside people's heads. And so that led me on a kind of a detour to NYU, where I did a postdoc in neuroscience. That's basically like a second PhD. Then I was at Duke for 15 years in the School of Medicine as a neurobiology professor teaching med students and doing research and ultimately was director of the Institute for Brain Sciences, which kind of put me on the path to being here because part of my job there, part of my charge was to not only connect all the neuroscientists together who were in the School of Medicine and the rest of campus, but to provide a bridge to open conversations between neuroscience and other disciplines like business, like law, like humanities, like arts even, and to find those points of articulation, because ultimately, in everything we do, there's a human brain that's behind everything, right? I mean, and you spoke eloquently in the introduction here about how we can do our jobs better, how we can be better human beings, and really who we are and how we perform ultimately as a result of how our brains are functioning.
Absolutely. And the title of this podcast is Tax at the Speed of Tech. The backbone of the conversation is rooted in tax technology. But to your point, the brain is involved in all of these functions and disciplines and in doing better, just in the way that you aspired to kind of get under the hood. You got to you got to kind of take a step back and understand what's really the driving force.
Yeah. And I think that's the message of my course. That's the message of my work. And I think what people may not realize is that what's going on in your head, what's driving your behavior, driving your decisions, you know, most of that, 99.99% of that is beneath your awareness. It's unobservable to you. And so it's difficult for you to understand what's going on and how to act on that, right? And the tools of modern neuroscience actually allow us to see what's happening. And so we have, at this point, a pretty deep and rich understanding of the basic processes that are involved when we make decisions, when we use technology, when we learn, when we, you know, when we remember something from our childhood, when we connect with our loved ones, when we work well with a team or not work well with a team, how we respond to a leader. We're getting a really good understanding of that in general, and a deeper understanding what accounts for differences between people, because frankly, we're not all alike. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those differences are the result of kind of both what we're endowed with from our parents, what we were born with, and our experiences growing up, and what we, and how we, you know, and what we do and how we use our brains. And so that understanding is putting us in a position, which really gets to your point about the brain being like a muscle. Once we know about those differences, we can understand how can you turn the dial, right? How can we turn some things up and turn some things down? How sticky are some of those dials? Like, they don't move very much, and you know, versus some of those dials you can move a lot. Mm-hmm. Just by working on it. And that's kind of the really exciting place that we're at right now.
Yeah, in any leadership course now, there's some element of unconscious bias. And I think not that I have an issue with it, but I think the limitation of that, let's say, is that it puts the scope of that bias centered on interactions between two people and basing those interactions on, you know, any number of their historical performance, them relative to another performer on the team, things like that. Whereas I think through the course, we referred to the brain as preferentially processing data with certain levels of bias. And to your point, that's all of the environmental factors, and that's all of the decisions that you're making.
Absolutely. And I think bias is a really good topic for showing the value of neuroscience. It's quite clear that we're all biased, right? And that's just sort of human nature. And that bias arises from a number of different sources. A lot of that has to do with your experience, kind of the environment you grew up in. And if we think about implicit bias, especially towards people of ethnic groups that we don't belong to, right, that we didn't grow up in, that, you know, whether you want to call that race or not, becoming aware of bias, going through bias training, hasn't really moved the needle much on how people's experiences in the workplace and, for example, you know, advancements of people from underrepresented groups to higher levels within firms, within any kind of organization. Over 20, 30 years of anti-bias training hasn't really had an impact. And it's not because people are evil or they're acting in bad faith. It's because, as I mentioned before, most of our behavior, our moment-to-moment interactions, are pretty much, you know, driven on the fly by brain systems that are kind of running beneath our awareness and not necessarily directly under, quote-unquote, our control, right? And what neuroscience has shown us, and you know, I think this was vividly demonstrated in the course, is that, you know, you might say you feel pain for somebody who's experiencing something painful, but who's from a different ethnic group than you, but your brain might tell us a very different story. And that seems to be the case, which is that our kind of default brain response, like our default, the activation or not of the parts of our brain that are involved in empathy, depends a lot on who you grew up with. And that's kind of the key, right? It suggests that, I mean, in as much as, and I believe this, diversity is a goal in its own right, because it leads to better representation. It leads to, you know, potentially more innovative solutions because you have different perspectives. But it's also kind of a mechanism to get us to a place of greater equity and inclusion. So that's just one tiny, tiny example, maybe not so tiny, but an important example of the ways in which looking under the hood can reveal something that we didn't suspect and potentially point us toward a solution that we might not have thought would be the one that would be effective.
Yeah, that's also just one example of how relatable neuroscience can be in almost a sneaky way where, you know, you can talk about that and for a moment forget that we're talking about neuroscience, right? You're talking about social behaviors and things, right? But, you know, talking about practicing putting yourself in diverse environments so you can have that awareness, or practicing innovation to train your brain to think a certain way, or practicing being social. So the social network in your brain, you know, is more attuned to interact and to synchronize with those that you're interacting with, right? There was so much of the course that I found surprisingly relatable. What are some common misconceptions about neuroscience that you come across? And what did you seek to accomplish by targeting a course centered in neuroscience to business?
Yeah, so let's get to your second point, which is why did I do this? And, you know, it's a good question. I thought the time is ripe, right? We have learned so much that that we can actually use it, right? It can be useful. And it's my conviction that neuroscience can help us to build better societies, to be better parents, to be better partners, to be better members of our community, and also to do business better. And that's really the mission of Wharton Neuroscience, which is to use the insights and technology and analytics of neuroscience to make business more efficient, more effective, and more humane. And I think that's sort of the trifecta that we're after, right? Which is kind of universal improvement. So that's why we did it. I don't remember the first part of your question, so maybe you could re-ask that.
What are some common misconceptions about neuroscience?
Yeah, there's so many misconceptions. I mean, one I think is that it's hard, right? And there's no way you're gonna understand it. It's brain science after all. Mm-hmm. But as you said, it can be made very accessible. And I think that some of the most important findings can be immediately put into practice, right? So that's one misconception. You know, I think another is that it's a lot of the technology is sort of beyond access. In business, for example, most people think, if they think of neuroscience at all, they're thinking of kind of pretty pictures of brightly colored brains, you know, that are from people doing brain imaging experiments. And yeah, that's great. We use brain imaging all the time. You know, you stick somebody in an MRI machine, take snapshots of their brain in action. But that's expensive and that's cumbersome. You can't put an MRI machine on a customer's head to see how they're thinking about your ads. But that's only one part of the technology. There's so many other more scalable neurotechnologies that are out there that can, you know, that for relatively little cost and little in the way of training and expertise, you can actually use, you can put into practice. I mean, we're doing that right now with companies across the United States, where literally we have citizen scientists who are, measuring their brain activity while they're at work and while they're engaged in various kinds of activities. And that's providing some really, you know, really, I think, innovative insights into performance. So how do we, you know, how can we use that information to help guide people to better interactions in the workplace, to better communication, to understanding, you know, why they're not, you know, hitting it off with particular members of their teams? And the thing, again, that's just scratching the surface. So those are a couple of misconceptions. I guess the third one would be that, sort of your brain is wired at birth and you know, there's not much you can do about it. Mm-hmm. That's just not the truth either. So, you know, your brain really is like a muscle, and the things that you practice, the things that you repeat, your brain gets better at, and the things that, as you said, that you let languish, those processes come to waste away a little bit. And so, in many respects, it's all up to you, right? And that, what an amazing opportunity, right? You can get better.
Yeah, you're the one in control.
Yep.
So those are some common misconceptions. I think on the flip side, there was so much in the course and in your book, The Leader's Brain, where there's stuff that, you have an idea that exists, in the zeitgeist of, I should do X a certain way, but the ideas behind it was really rooted in science. For example, right, everyone knows that long presentations or wordy PowerPoint slides are ineffective because of short attention spans, right? That's kind of just one of those common sense givens. But through the lens of neuroscience, right, the real reason is that the neurons function like a battery, draining and recharging, drawing massive amounts of energy from the body. Do you think if people knew the science behind some of these ideas, they'd be less likely to commit these crimes?
Well, one would hope so. I mean, and that's been the sort of mission that I've been on for the last 6 or 7 years, doing, a lot through executive education and just speaking and writing a book, which is to, it's my hope, and conviction that if people understand and they want to do better, then they have the tools to actually do things better. And I've seen that in my own, even in my own lab group here, when we were mid-pandemic and everybody got so used to working from home. And then once everybody got vaccinated, I said, well, it's now time to come back because there are so many ways in which being in person in the same place together adds something unique that you just can't, it just doesn't happen through virtual interactions. In fact, a lot of our research right now is understanding what is different about working on Zoom or whatever your video conferencing platform of choice might be versus being in the same place with another person. So what I did was I said, well, I'm going to present the data to you, people in my lab, about what has happened with the pandemic and innovation going through the floor, and because social networks have collapsed and well-being plummeted, and it's basically because we need each other, right? Mm-hmm. We are a social species like no other, and it is the key part of our adaptive toolkit, evolved a long time ago. It's why we have been able to kind of conquer the earth and build institutions and build rocket ships and all that stuff, is because we can do more things together than we can do alone. And we saw that very vividly in the pandemic, when everybody was working from home. And so I said, look, here's the data, here's what happened, and here's why that happened. And here's why we need to come back into the lab. Mm-hmm. It's not like we all just came back in immediately, but it was an important point, I think, to present the science and make that compelling. And in the case of what you're talking about with regard to PowerPoint presentations that are 120 slides, and each slide has 50 bullet points and flaming logos and watermarks and all of these distractions. Our brains, despite the fact that we have 86 or so billion neurons in our brains, there's actually a lot of limitations on what your brain can do. And a big part of that is energetic demands. So every time any individual neuron, the fundamental processing unit in your brain, sends a signal, an electrical signal, which is magical, right? This is an amazing thing that brains can do. They can make electrical messages. That's a really complicated process that takes the requires the movement of ions across membranes and things like that. That is, like you said, discharging a battery, and that battery has to be reset, which takes energy. And resetting that battery, for some neurons, has to happen 1,000 times a second, which is not trivial. And for that reason, our brains eat up about 20% of the calories. 20% of the calories you consume are going to your brain, believe it or not. That's pretty much at physiological limits. And for that reason, our brains have evolved to be very, very efficient. So our brains are efficient by focusing on what's important by throwing out distracting information. And unfortunately, our brains can get overwhelmed when there's just too much there. And the neuroscience has shown that very, very vividly. So if you measure brain activity while people are watching advertisements or trailers from movies, what you see is like, yeah, you can get a great, you know, signal saying your brain's really paying attention and processing all this information. And that can happen for like 6 to 10 seconds. And then it's like, it just falls away. And, you know, that's why TikTok videos are short, right? Because it hits the sweet spot in terms of like the amount of information that we can process.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, returning to work versus working remote. I'm one of those folks who is remote, because if I went to the office, none of my team would be there because we're spread out, right? So what we can do is turn on our cameras, right? At the very least, right? Because you can get social cues from facial expressions, and it's still enough of a form of eye contact that you're building associations and relationships at a neuronal level, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we... Well, we can be a little bit more nuanced about it, let's say. So on the one hand, yes. So I think that if the pandemic had happened 10 years earlier, we would have been sunk because we didn't have these capabilities. So it immediately opened up access, and it made working from home doable. The question is, like, how do we optimize around that? So one thing we learned is that because of the differences between being in the real world and being online, our brains have to work a little bit harder when we're on a Zoom call, for example, because there's just the physical cues, right? Facial expressions, direction of gaze, changes in pupil dilation, all these things we're not really aware of, but our brains are hoovering up that information all the time. That's what our brains are designed to do. So they have to work harder to get that information because it's not as clear. Right. And the more windows you have in a Zoom call that are open, the less information there is. So our brains get a little bit tired. That's why Zoom fatigue is a real thing. So understanding that it's a real thing as a real source in the way our brains process information, I think, is important for how we then approach work from home. Don't schedule back to back to back to back to back meetings. Right. I mean, I know that. I know that from the data. But unfortunately, I still get scheduled back to back to back to back, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you're right. Having your cameras on, having these physical social cues is important. But we have to be mindful of how we operate within that environment. So one thing, for example, is a tendency, and this gets back to the issue you talked about with distractions and attentiveness. Many of us, I'm guilty. Right now, I've got 3 screens open. Those are potential distractions, right? And when they're open, that means I'm just by nature, and this is built into our brains too, I'm cycling through all these different sources of potential inputs, which means I'm less attentive to you. And if you see that I'm looking over there, then even if you're not consciously aware of it, your brain is saying, hey, he's not paying attention to me. He's not connected with me. That starts to set up, you know, some distrust, some bad feelings, right? So I think that when we are, like, the perfect way to do this would be to have, you know, a limited number of people on the call. Everybody puts everything else away. No device is open. And you're invested in that conversation, but you keep it short.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That would be ideal.
Yep. Like how I have dinner with my kids, right? The devices, everything goes away. We're going to make eye contact. We're all present. We're all here. Another symptom of, you know, remote work and the pandemic and everything certainly is the sedentary nature of folks, you know, being at home, right? You go to the office, you're commuting, you're walking upstairs, you know, you're getting at least a modicum of exercise. Can you talk for a moment about the relationship to kind of brain function and everything we've been talking about to, you know, the other systems of the body, gut health, physical health, right? The whole system.
Yeah, and this is a really important point that I think had been just not attended to at all. which is that when you are working from home, as you said, just think about the number of steps you're taking. Maybe you get up and you walk 10 feet to the bathroom or 5 feet to the refrigerator. And instead of, you know, walking to the subway or walking mm-hmm. to the car and going up the stairs or walking from one part of the building to another for a meeting, and that all adds up. And one thing that we have learned that is, you know, undeniably probably one of the biggest brain hacks out there is that movement is key to the physical health of your brain. So if I could tell you to do one thing to make sure that you keep cognitive decline at bay as long as possible, is to move, to physically move. Physical exercise is key not only to physical health, but it's key to brain health as well. There's a second piece to this. So keep your brain healthy and alive, one. But the other is that when we're up and moving, when we disengage from the computer, when we disengage from the screen, this allows a part of this sort of network of our brain that's involved in getting things done, this sort of focused attention task execution network. And when that shuts down, this other network, the sort of yang to the yin of task execution, which we call the innovation network, sometimes called the default mode network. So that network comes online when we're out walking around, when we're spacing out, when you're vacuuming the rug, you know, whatever, when you're on a run. And that network is the key to creativity and innovation, right? And in fact, that's why it's so difficult, and this is measurable, and it has been documented, to be creative, to be innovative, when we're sitting in front of a computer, for example, typing numbers into a spreadsheet. But even on a Zoom call, it's harder to be creative and innovative because that other person's face is capturing and holding your attention and activating that attention network, so that innovation network has a lot of trouble getting started. So even something as simple as turning around can kickstart the process, get up and go for a walk. So I had always found myself doing this, is that, you know, I get up and move probably every 20 minutes, every 30 minutes. I can't it's part of my nature, but my best ideas come to me when I'm walking back and forth from work, or I'm out on a run or out on a bike ride. So movement is key. And unfortunately, you know, working from home means that you have to be more mindful. You have to be more intentional. Mm-hmm. About making opportunities to get up, to move around, and ideally to go out and walk around.
And I think it's one of those examples where I think folks might be more intentional if they kind of knew this angle of it, right? Because everyone's been told, they know, right? I should try and schedule it for 55 minutes instead of an hour, so I've got a break, or I need to get up and move around. I know I should do those things. But only because I've been told I should do those things. Whereas if I were to really take it seriously and be intentional, I could actually be more productive or have better quality output. And I think this topic hits home with the community who's going to be listening here, right? Where they're tax practitioners, right? So the tasks that they're often dealing with, they're buried in Excel sheets and executing manual tasks, calculating numbers, assembling reports, right? So, you know, kind of getting back to my intro as well, and with everything we were just saying about being sedentary, you know, in addition to doing some of those things to improve the innovation network and the ability to be creative, you know, have there been any studies around actually employing technology or equipping humans with better tools to accomplish roles that additionally contribute to that ability to be creative or innovative?
This is a great question. I think it's undeniable that technology over the course of the last couple hundred years, increases, improvements in the technology have allowed us to be more productive. Absolutely. But that's kind of leveled off. It's kind of stalled out. In the past, I don't know, a couple of decades, probably because we're doing a lot of things that maybe, you know, are superfluous, Like, you know what I mean? I mean, they're not necessarily oriented toward the highest value outcomes. Mm. So that's one thing that's worth considering. And I think that's one reason why we all feel kind of buried by work, and that it makes it challenging to say, you know, come hell or high water, 4 o'clock comes and I'm going for my walk, right? Because you just got a queue in your inbox that says, you know, you've got so many things to do. That said, we are at this very moment at the precipice. You know, it's happening right now in terms of game-changing, godlike technology in the form of AI. Mm-hmm. That in the best case scenario can amplify what any individual can do, can take away some of the, you know, to basically lighten your load, right? To make it easier to get your job done. And if your job can be done more efficiently and more effectively, that potentially leaves more time for you to do the things that will keep your brain, for example, and your body functioning at a higher level, which will make you ultimately, right, better at your job, better at life, more, you know, more employable, all right, more likely to advance. I think it's just a question of, like, how does this technology ultimately get used, right, for good or for evil?
Right. And then what's the impact on our brains, right? I saw a story just last week, a very neuroscience-centered story around this, I think it's a university study, using fMRIs to project images from the brain from memory that had kind of stalled for a while, but then using AI, you know, layered into the fMRI scans, were able to generate not 100% accurate, but pretty good, you know, general colors and things, right? If they had looked at a giraffe in a jungle, you could kind of make out a giraffe in a jungle from the image that was projected using the AI in a very Minority Report type of way.
Oh, it's astonishing at this point what can be done in terms of, for all intents and purposes, mind reading. So, and honestly, this capability has been around for more than a decade, but it's really, really advanced. So if somebody is watching a movie in an MRI machine, you can pretty accurately project out what they're watching. Okay, so that's a sensory input. Well, when we imagine things, when we remember episodes and events, we're engaging the same parts of our brain that are engaged when we experience those things in the first place. So there's no reason to suppose that we could not do that, in the sense of, like, being able to see, like, what are you thinking about? What are you remembering, right? What are you dreaming about? And, you know, again, I mean, this gets back to sort of my Peter Parker principle, which is, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. What are we going to do with that? Mm-hmm. Like, use this technology to help people do better and be better, or are we going to use it in some sort of, you know, really dystopian, destructive fashion?
Yeah, I think this is going to be another cliffhanger, as we said, on this precipice of AI for the tax community as well, where, you know, there's so many conversations of, well, can I just ask ChatGPT to, you know, work out this tax problem for me? I'll feed it all the tax code that tells me how I need to file a tax return a certain way, and it'll just put the numbers in the right place, calculate everything, and do it. You know, if we get to that point where we're relying on technology so heavily, will tax practitioners not focus as much on the tax code? And when it comes to a complex area, be able to interpret it, right, without that, the training of that particular muscle?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, again, this is remains to be seen. There was, I don't know if you saw the open letter, one of the signatories.
Everyone saw the open letter. Was, yeah.
I signed it. You know, it's take a pause, right?
Yeah.
I don't really know where this is going. We want to make sure that we use this in a way that is equitable and that advances human flourishing, not that results in inequities and misery and unhappiness.
But, or human extinction.
Or human extinction. I don't remember what it was. It's either 10% or 20% of AI.
10, yeah.
A 10% survey said, there's a reasonable likelihood of human extinction. But let's assume that's not going to happen. I think what the exciting thing, and I think this is what we've been discussing in a sense, is that if, for example, people who work in your industry in tax can be freed from some of the more laborious aspects of the job, then that opens up opportunities to be more innovative, creative, to think about new ways to confront some of these challenges, or make new kinds of connections around that. So I think that's the upside here.
Right, and those tax practitioners can further increase the likelihood of that by exercising, taking breaks, eating good foods that give the right, caloric fuel to the brain and the right types of nutrients.
Yeah, I mean, you need calories, but, as we've seen, you can go overboard on that. So it's not just about calories. And the other thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that, another really key ingredient to a brain healthy diet is protein. So a lot of the chemicals that our brains rely on for proper functioning, especially ones that people are probably pretty aware of, like dopamine and the adrenaline in your brain and serotonin and whatnot, they have to be assembled from amino acids in your diet. And those amino acids have to come from protein. So so think of yourself like any good, like Arnold Schwarzenegger or whoever, drinking a protein shake in the morning in preparation for your workout at the gym. You should do the same thing for your workout in the mental gym as well.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect place to wrap up. I could talk to you all day, Professor, but also being respectful that we are a few minutes before the hour and you probably want to get up and move around, take a break before your next meeting. So let's practice what we preach. And thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Well, I appreciate that. And thanks for the conversation. It's always great.
Thanks for listening to Tax at the Speed of Tech, a BDO podcast. If you like the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Head to BDO.com to access resources cited in this episode and learn more about BDO's approach to tax innovation. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, or if you want to discuss your organization's tax technology strategy, send us an email at tax@thespeedoftech@BDO.com.